So, we are wrapping up our Lenten series. It's the fifth week of Lent, and we are now into our last section of letters. So we will start with We will start with letter 25. The same old thing. Screwtape starts off by identifying the problem with the Christian. He's not just, he's not just a Christian. But the problem is, he's merely Christian. Screwtape wants him to be Christian and. He wants him to be something additional. He borrows this term from a theologian from the 17th century, a Puritan of all things, whose name was Richard Baxter. And this guy named Baxter referred to himself as a mere Christian. He said, if I have to be referred to anything, call me a Catholic Christian. He spelled it really funny. He spelled it It ended with a C-K. I can't even spell it now. I'm going to just make myself sound like an idiot on the recording. But it ended with a C-K, okay? And it was ironic that you have this Puritan theologian who says, call me a Catholic because I believe in the universal church. But Screwtape doesn't want that because he says, what we want, if men become Christians at all, is to have them in a state of what I call Christianity and. You know, if they must be Christians, let them be Christians with a difference. Substitute for the faith itself some fashion with a Christian coloring. Work on their horror of the same old thing. So he gives this long list of Christianity and, Christianity and the new politics. Christianity and maybe Christianity and patriotism. Maybe Christianity and privacy rights, maybe Christianity and the pro-life movement, maybe Christianity and who knows what else, maybe Christianity and the Republican Party. We can go into all sorts of things. Maybe Christianity and gay rights, there's those group out there too. There's all sorts of these people who are out there saying, I'm a Christian and through Screwtape, Lewis is saying, no, we just need to be Christians. Okay? Now, he has this, and this is a great section here. It's absolutely beautiful. He describes how, because we're temporal creatures, we're creatures who are in time, because we're in time, we have this need for change. And because God likes us, he makes change pleasant for us. But because we're destined for eternity, we also like things to be constant. And because of that, we like a sense of constancy. So God gives us this thing that is always going back and forth, which is called rhythm. All right? So, he gives them the seasons, each season different, yet each every year the same, so that spring is always felt as a novelty, yet always the recurrence of an immemorial theme. All right? So, because we need change and like change, we have things that repeat. But because we have this need for permanence, because we're destined for permanence and eternity, we have these things that come back. We have this change and this permanence. So we have these cycles. And he gives them, his church, a spiritual year that they change from fast to feast, but it is the same feast as the year before. Anybody ever thought about the church year like that? This continual cycle so that we have the change of being creatures in time, but the permanence of being creatures that are destined for eternity? Anybody ever thought about that? It's just a really lovely way of describing the church year. I really like that. But he continues on and says, now we just pick out and exaggerate the pleasure of eating to produce gluttony. So we pick out this natural pleasantness of change and twist it into a demand for absolute novelty. Only by our incessant efforts is this demand for the infinite or unrhythmical change kept up. This demand is valuable in various ways. So the demons say, okay, yes, they like change. We have to pervert this. Change is good to an extent. They need a little change. It's part of who they are. We have to make this incessant. They like food. Food's good for them. Food's pleasurable for them. We have to make it so much that it's a sin. So we're going to take it and take this need for change that they have and make it just an absolute sin. And so, in the first place, it diminishes pleasure while increasing desire. The pleasure of novelty is by its very nature more subject than any other to the law of diminishing returns. That's an economic thing. Anybody know what the law of diminishing return is? In economics, you have this idea that you can, no matter how much you put into a project, it gets to a point where no matter how much you put into it, you don't get more return out. I can't really think of a necessary example of it, but at a certain point, it doesn't matter how many employees you put on a housing project, you're not going to get it built any faster. So putting them onto the project only raises your cost. It doesn't get it built any faster. Okay? That's a law of diminishing returns, and it's a point of diminishing returns. Again and again, the more rapacious this desire, the sooner it must eat up all the innocent sources of pleasure and pass on to those the enemy forbids. Look, if you're somebody who absolutely has to try things that are new, eventually you're going to run out of all the pleasant and licit new things, and eventually you're going to have to start trying the things that are no-nos. Right? You run out of these are okay things to try that are new. Eventually, you're out of bungee jumping, and you're out of skydiving, and you're out of the regular things, and then you're into the things that you just shouldn't be doing. Begin your list of illicit activities, things that send you to a conversation that begins with, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Or at least should. Okay? Then we go to the next reason. The use of fashions is to distract the attentions of men away from real dangers. This is another use of novelty. This, what he refers to as this continual sense of need for newness, to distract men away from the real dangers. We distract the fashionable outcry of each generation away from those vices which it is in least of danger and fix its approval on the virtue nearest to that vice which we are trying to make endemic. Okay? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but look at the next slide. The game is to have them running about with fire extinguishers wherever there is a flood and crowding to that side of the boat which is really nearly gunnels under. Thus we make fashionable to expose the dangers of enthusiasm at the very moment when they are all really becoming worldly and lukewarm. Essentially, what you do is you get everybody really panicky about, being overzealous, when really the problem is that nobody has any passion. The real problem of a generation is that they have no passion at all. They're just mild, lukewarm, insipid little do-nothings. And the demons get out there and work on them and say, the real problem with this generation is that you're too enthusiastic and you're too zealous. And that zealotry is just driving all sorts of problems in the church and the world, and it's turning people away from the church, and they look at you and they hear your sermons and they're like, why would I want to be a part of that? Because those people are just, they're just hate mongers. And so people in the church say, we're not going to be like that. And so they stop. And they become more and more like the problem that is really going on. Can we think of any situations that might be going on like that in the church now? It may not be that example, you know, precisely, but you know, we've heard for a while now that people are picking on homosexuality. You know, everyone's talking about, you know, the you know, why is it we single out homosexuality as a major issue in the church when there's all these other sins that are significant? Okay, why is it that we focus on gays, we don't talk about people who are shacking up with each other, all right, cohabitating or anything along those lines, or simply fornicating? Why don't we, you know, address those issues as well? Okay, well, maybe that's true. Maybe it's a different issue. Maybe we ought to be addressing all of them, but it's that same sort of thing. Why are we singling one and reducing the other? Why are we highlighting, why are we exaggerating one and ignoring others? Why is one sin fashionable and the other sort of quietly brushed away? He continues, because the greatest triumph of all is to elevate the horror of the same old thing into a philosophy so that the nonsense in the intellect may reinforce the corruption of the will. He wants men to ask a very simple question. Is it righteous? Is it prudent? Is it possible? Is it holy? Should it be done? Can it be done? Now, if we keep men asking, is it progressive or reactionary? Is that the way history is going? They will neglect the relevant question. I've raised this up in this conversation before. There's a picture that keeps popping up on Facebook of on one hand it is people protesting some sort of parade or something. On the other, it's people trying to keep little black children from going into school. Mm-hmm. And the caption on it is, "In 50 years, you're going to look like such an idiot." Okay, which is really, is it progressive or reactionary? Not at all. Is it righteous? Is it prudent? Is it possible? Those are the real questions. You know, is it good? Is it true? Is it beautiful? Is it righteous? Is it prudent? Is it possible? Those are the real questions. Who cares if it's reactionary, if it's righteous? If we're reacting and it's righteous, so be it. If we're reacting righteously, prudently, so be it. You know, if we have to go down as the one person in history that stands up and says, this is wrong and I resist it, then so be it. Speaking of pictures on Facebook, I love the one picture that I've seen of the rally in Nazi Germany where you've got about 450 people standing there like this with their arms held up saluting Hitler, and the one guy who's standing there like this. All right? And it said, make sure you're that one guy. Okay? If you can be that guy, all the better. And one last slide on this issue. Said, for the descriptive adjective unchanged, we have substituted the emotional adjective stagnant. Think about that. We make it appear as if anything that has remained the same is a bog, is some smelly, foul swamp. Not that it's, you know, stood the test of time. No, it's wretched and foul. We have trained them to think of the future as a promised land which favored heroes attain, not as something which everyone reaches at the rate of 60 minutes an hour, whatever he does, whoever he is. Face it, folks, we're all going to get to the future, whether we're heroes or not. Okay. Let's go on to letter 26. Unselfishness. There were some jewels in this one. I don't know if everybody got a chance to read these. Some of these were really, really priceless. Since they are now very serious, Screwtape advises Wormwood to use the charitable feelings towards each other, that's the patient and his girlfriend, as a cover to smuggle in the seeds that will become domestic strife later in life. They're feeling all these warm fuzzies. Use that time to plant seeds that 20 years from now will just ruin their marriage. The demons are aided by the fact that each sex generally views the word unselfish in completely different terms. This is just golden right here. Look at this. A woman means by unselfish chiefly taking troubles for another. A man means not giving trouble to others. Just ponder that for a little bit. As a result, a woman who is quite far gone in the enemy's service will make a nuisance of herself on a larger scale than any man except those whom our father has dominated completely. And conversely, a man will live long in the enemy's camp before he undertakes as much spontaneous work to please others as a quite ordinary woman may do every day. Thus, while the woman thinks of doing good offices and the man of respecting the other people's rights, each sex, without an obvious unreason, can and does regard the other as radically selfish. You're not to speak of my language. Essentially, to the woman, being unselfish is doing things for other people. To the man, being unselfish is making sure that other people don't have to do things for him. Not doing things for other people, but making sure people don't have to do his work. For example, when you stay at someone's house or a guest at their house, making your bed in the morning when you leave would be a man's view of being unselfish. Okay? That would be a manly view of unselfishness. Okay? Nobody has to come in and make up your bed and do your dirty work. Okay? Manly unselfishness. Womanly unselfishness would be making somebody else's bed. Okay? That would be womanly unselfishness. Dude, I was just passing time, okay? Anyway. Never mind. It was a joke. I know. I thought I would at least get a chuckle, but anyway. The Lenten retreat. We were getting ready on our last day there. I ended up making up Kevin's bed. It wasn't I was being unselfish. I was bored. We had time to spare. I just folded up some sheets. It wasn't a big deal. I feel pretty. And you know what? I looked smashing in that dress, by the way. Anyway. And now I've totally lost my place. Oh, there we are. All right. So I just find that just really, really amusing. This whole idea of this. And then he has this other thing. I didn't quote it in a slide because it just was too long. But he has this concept of, he calls it the generous conflict illusion, which I have seen. I have seen this, and the context I see it is, where are we going to go after church? Okay? Okay? The generous conflict illusion, he uses, what are we going to do, or adult children deciding what they're going to do for a parent's birthday. Okay? And one child volunteers, not really wanting to do it, but thinking the others might agree to it, we could have a tea party. And the other says, you know what, I really don't want to do that, but for the sake of you people, I would agree to it. And the other two, or three, or however many, refusing to let this one be the martyr, say, oh, no, no, we would never want you to do something that you don't want to. And so ultimately, everyone gets offended because they end up not doing something that no one really wanted to do in the first place. And the demons just sit there and go, score. This stuff's easy. I have seen people in a parking lot after church be like, why don't we go here? I don't want to go there. I mean, I'll go there if you want to, but I don't want to go there. Well, fine, if you don't want to, no, if you want to go there, we'll go there, but I just don't really want to go there. Well, if you want to go there, then we'll go there. But I don't want to go there if you don't want to go there. Well, fine, we'll go somewhere else. No, if you want to go. And, you know, what ends up happening? They end up going home. All right, so.
No, we go somewhere.
And it's, you know, high five. Yeah, and
we go somewhere, but everybody's mad.
Yeah, exactly. And somebody's telling you where you can go. Anyway. And the demons are giving each other high fives. Anyway, there's a reason we go to the same five places every Sunday. Anyway. All right. Letter 27. Prayers and predestination. Oh. Okay. This one had the most amazing explanation in it. And it's really brief. And actually, the lead up to it was really complicated and very hard to understand. I'm not really going to talk about it at all. But the actual nugget at the end was beautiful. And you could sit and contemplate it for a long, long time. But he starts off, and Screwtape briefly addresses the issue of distraction in prayers. He says, we want him, the patient, to try and stay focused by force of will and determination, not by petitioning prayer, but petitioning God for aid in avoiding distractions. By all means, make him say, I am going to stay focused. Focus, focus, focus. Not say, Lord, I'm really distracted here. Help me stay focused. Because, you know, that would be the reasonable thing to do when you're praying and asking God for help with everything else that's going on in your life. If you have problems, say, Lord, help me be focused in my prayers. But then he goes to, talk about this idea of false spirituality. And he talks about false spirituality and says, look, get him to think about this idea that prayers where he asks for things are crude petitionary prayers. And those are just fleshly prayers. They're not spiritual prayers. They're not true prayers. True prayers are spiritual things. And he says, you have to get him to neglect the whole thing that God commanded them to pray for their daily bread. Try and make them forget that. Says, you know, be sure that you neglect that thought. Because, you know, God said, pray for your daily bread. That's not a crude petitionary prayer. God knows that you need these things. He talked about it. That whole Matthew 5 chapter where we're talking about the lilies of the field and the birds of the air and how God provides for these. We talk about don't worry, right? God says, I know you need these things. I will give them to you. Don't fret about them. He knows you need them. If you want them, ask for them. He'll give them to you. It's not wrong to ask for them. Now, it may be wrong to fret about them. It may be wrong to make them such a priority in your life that they're all you think about, or you fixate on them. But what's not wrong is to say, Lord, I have a need and I want to bring it to you. Because God says, ask me to give you your daily bread. Then he goes on to talk about predestination. Okay? And in this, he's talking about how a man's prayers for weather and how a prayer in the past could affect the future and vice versa. How could a guy say, Lord, help me have a beautiful day tomorrow. Help it not rain on our church picnic. You know, there are some people who say it's absolute hogwash. It's never going to happen. Or they come up with this heads I win, tails you lose thing, where if it is a beautiful day, well, it was going to be a beautiful day anyway. And if it isn't, well, then your prayers didn't work. Okay? But let's look at the slides. The use of his love to distract the mind from the enemy is, of course, obvious. But you reveal what poor use of you are making. Wow, this is a little bad. The chief subject of love means you have largely failed. Let's go on to the next slide. Again, this is talking, I've gone on and talked about this already. Okay, here we are. If you try to explain to him that men's prayers today are one of the innumerable coordinates with which the enemy harmonizes the weather of tomorrow, he would reply that the enemy always knew men were going to make those prayers, and if so, they did not pray freely, but were predestined to do so. Okay? And then we get into that giant, huge slough of despair of what are we going to do with the predestination free will issue? How do you handle that? And this is maybe the best answer I've ever heard. Look up here. How it does so is not a problem at all. For the enemy does not foresee the humans making their free contributions in a future, but sees them doing so in his unbounded now. And obviously, to watch a man doing something is not to make him do it.